Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, we are in the middle of our 60-plus program discussion of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and I just want to get right back into it. So if you haven't listened to last week's program, you better listen to that first. But one of the things that we were talking about in the last program was kind of like how mysterious the book is and how there's certain things aren't answered. I thought let's talk a little bit about the characters and you know, of course we have, you know, four main ones, and of course at the very beginning of the book we are introduced to Aronnax and then his faithful companion Conseil, but then we meet up with Nemo, and so one of the things that I brought up in the introduction is I did say that Jules Verne probably was, you know, very much into evolution. But then when I got in more into the book, you know, I noticed that Aronnax, he's the one that talks about, you know, evolution and the time it took for the animals to get to a certain point, or the sea animals. But it's interesting that Nemo is the one that talks about God as creator, talks about life in the sea, and talks about, he seems to have this religious bent. So maybe we could just open up the discussion now on characters and maybe let's try and resolve this issue a little bit about whether he was really into evolution or if he was not. So I'll just throw that out. Whoever grabs it first, grab it.
Well, I could make a comment about Nemo, because I think it is interesting. You mentioned about the kind of figure he is, and the fact that he does mention God, and he speaks of the Creator, and he, in all his studies that he's seen across the world, he obviously recognizes the role of that. In a lot of ways, when you look at Nemo, he is a godlike figure himself, because he rules his universe, which is the Nautilus. Basically, he sets the law there. Everyone sort of toes as he sees the way, and in a lot of ways, he is in a role like that. He's in a godlike role, and everyone's very subservient to him. Everyone
Absolutely.
Depends on him for their freedom. He has control over their freedom and their destiny. So he has them on this boat, and they can't leave without basically his permission or his making it so that they can. And so it's interesting that he is a mysterious figure in many ways. In fact, all the figures have some aspect of mystery about them, but especially so Nemo. He's very mysterious. And the way he interacts and the way he disappears. I mean, he's there for a while, and then he won't be present for a long period of time. You understand, well, why is that? And then he has certain changes of mood that are sort of unexplained. You sort of understand that later as you get into the book and sort of realize maybe some of the things that may have happened to him that caused that. But there is a certain mystery about the book that I think adds to the appeal, because you're wanting to read more. I find myself wanting to read more to try to resolve these mysteries, because, you know, when you met Nemo, it's like, well, what a strange and odd character. I want to read more about him and try to understand his thinking, you know. And you never really quite get there, but it's that mystery does add a great dimension to the book, I think.
Yeah, I want to just add something to what you just said there, because, first of all, it's true. He is, I mean, he has absolute power. I mean, even the way he invented the Nautilus, it's an absolutely powerful invention. He does have his, like, all of his sidekicks. And I don't know, do we ever know exactly how many sailors are on board? I don't think we even know. No. But we know there's a great chef, you know. But the thing is he's a benevolent dictator. Right. If you call him a dictator, I mean, he's benevolent because he has them living in absolute glorious conditions. They have a library. They have an art museum. They also have, I don't know what the exact term is, but they can go in and they can study the different, you know, life forms from the sea. And it is almost like Nemo wants to get away from the world of humans. He says that. I want to get away from the world of humans. And he wants to be in the world of the sea where he feels like there's no evil, you know, there's no effects of human nature. There's no one can really damage you kind of thing. But then obviously when one of his sailors gets killed, there's obviously tragedy there as well. So I think, as we said last time, there is this humanistic side to the book that you don't necessarily see right away. You have to think about it. So, okay, ladies, any comments on Nemo? What is? Are you as, let's say, madly in love with him as Margaret Drabble was?
I wouldn't say I'm madly in love with him, no.
Thank you.
Thank you, my dear. But I was curious. He is curious. I think it's interesting. It's like, well, just the idea of him being like a godlike figure. I mean, he has created like this ideal world for the gentleman, you know, with a fantastic chef. And I mean, like you said, they're living in luxury and all with the...
And with sea cigars.
Yeah, and they even have cigars, yes.
Yeah, I wanted to say, are they herbal?
They're made from the sea.
No carcinogenic materials there?
I guess
there?
Not.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, so they're all the perfect things, except some person mentioned there's no women, of course, but they don't seem seem like they need women, but they, you know, they're very just busy with being able to study in the library, and Arinax is totally happy with that, and even Conseil seems to be happy there with, because every now and then they open up the windows and they can look out and see the beautiful scenery or the flora and fauna and the things in the sea there, and he's really enjoying that, and he's writing it down and being interested in all that, so it's like he's created this, you know, this special world that, you know, the ideal world that he, you know, he is most important to him, I guess. So,
yeah. You know. Okay. But in the back of your mind, you always get the feeling, what's really going on here? Mm-hmm. You know, there's the other thing that it seems like when Daryl brought up the point about he's a god, you know, like a god figure. I always get the feeling like he knows what's going on in their private cabins, because it seems like he knows things, you know, and almost like there's a part of a 1984 George L. Orwell kind of thinking that he's really, because it seems like he doesn't appear for a long time. And then when they're getting into a discussion that's kind of threatening to him and his world, he just all of a sudden just appears.
Yeah, you wonder if the rooms are bugged or what.
Right.
Yeah, early on when they're in the boat and they're first just adjusting to this idea that they're going to have to stay here, and they're saying, well, we're like trapped in a tin can, and then all of a sudden the lights go off inside and these portals open and the lights come on outside, and suddenly they're seeing this incredible world of sea life, and it's because they just said, well, yeah, like we're stuck inside with nothing to see, and then all of a sudden there's a view. So it did seem a little creepy that you're wondering if Captain Nemo is constantly listening in on their conversations.
Yeah, there is a creepy part to Captain Nemo.
Yes, yeah, well, there's that mystery. It's like it can't all be good. What's really going on? What's going to happen?
And the other thing that's odd too is when you look at the language, you know, obviously Ned and Arronax and Conseil are speaking French among themselves, but nobody else speaks French that we know of on the ship. I mean, on the submarine. Later, there's an indication that one person who speaks French is actually killed in an incident, and he yells out something in French. But it's like they're isolated linguistically. Nemo speaks to them in French, but he doesn't speak to anybody else apparently in French. He's speaking to them in some other language. So there's this sense of not even being in a submarine, but being linguistically isolated in this little group of French speakers in this ship where you don't know how many are there, but they're speaking some other language. So it's an interesting way he presents that in sense of feeling isolated even while you're in a ship like that, because you can't reach out to others in another language, you know.
Yeah, there is the one scene, this is all in the part one about Nemo as well, is he's by himself, and what's he doing? He's just working out algebraic, you know, problems. It's like,
without women, you have to keep yourself amused. Yeah, somehow.
It's like, okay, well,
play the piano, I think, or the organ.
Yeah, well, they could play. That's right, they could play music, yeah. But it's like I'm thinking, if I were by myself on that ship, I would not be in a room working out algebraic calculations. You know, it's not in my skill set. You know what I mean?
It is interesting, I think, because I've known academics and very scientifically minded people who are a lot like Conseil or Aronnax, who really can just pour themselves into their work and be completely engrossed in simply taxonomically categorizing things. I love that scene after the windows, you know, the portals open, and you see that contrast between Conseil, who is very scientifically capable of categorizing the creatures that he's seeing, and Ned Land, who has a very hands-on practical application, and he doesn't know what they are, he just knows what they taste like. Right. And he's basically like, oh, those are the tasty ones. And, you know, and so there's this really fun contrast between the personalities. They can both be very entertained for hours at end watching the sea life, but from very different perspectives. And maybe that explains why Aronnax could have been very content to travel the seas. You know, he's obviously spent a great deal of time doing this. Captain Nemo had been at this for who knows how much longer before. Because there are, I think, certain people who are just very, very enthralled by that kind of deep thinking and that solitude, and it doesn't bother them. And then there are other people for whom they would go batty.
Right, right. So, Deborah, what are you, anything else on Nemo before we move on? Because I have another question now.
Well, no, I'm thinking, that's about when to say.
Okay. So, Sarah, you just triggered something in my mind. Okay, so here we have Nemo, who is obviously a brilliant engineer. He's also a deep thinker. He's also very well educated, knows, you know, how many languages. You get the feeling that he knew the Latin, he knew all of those, and because he says to them, well, they don't understand Latin, and they don't understand French, and they don't understand all those languages. But the thing is do you think that maybe Verne is getting into, like, what would build like a utopian society? Here you have to have the engineer and the brain, then you have an Aronnax, then you have a Conseil, but then you have Ned. You know, and it's like, you know, is he you know, in the fall we're going to be doing utopian and dystopian literature, so I'm now reading, you know, like Bacon and more. So I'm into utopia stuff now. So, but do you think that's part of this, that you know, it seems like Nemo likes having them there. It seems like this was fortuitous for him, and it's almost like you get the feeling that maybe he's keeping them because he's protecting himself, but now I'm beginning to think maybe he's keeping them because he wants to develop something. So what do you all think about that?
I think that's an interesting thought. I had wondered about that with regard to the question, how did he bring the crewmen on board that are there, which you know nothing about? You don't know anything about, you know they're from various nationalities is all you know. But you wonder, what was his criteria in bringing them on? You know, the one guy that gets buried and he has the burial, right. The burial on the outside in the underwater cemetery. He was obviously very close to that person and knew the person somehow. Because of the way he reacted with that. But you wonder, well, what was the criteria that he had in bringing him on board? And so if you think that he's trying to handpick people to bring on board so that he creates his own society and he's recreating another society because he's disillusioned with the one that he came out of, then that's, you know, one way of thinking about it. However, he himself then, it's odd how then fortuitously Aronnax, as you say, Aronnax and Ned come on board. They weren't screened through any process. They just, you know, dropped out of the sky. But yet they seem to fit right into it, and he wanted to have them there. Certainly at least he wanted to have, I think, Aronnax for sure,
yeah.
And probably Conseil. And so you think, well, now what is being produced here? Is he, like you say, trying to create a world a society that's the ideal society here, or what? That's another mystery that's part of the book.
It very much, but notice that even when the sailor dies, you don't have a name. We don't have a name for him. I mean, is he really a sailor? What was his? Was he an engineer that worked in the engine room? You get that feeling he was in the engine room when this happened. But you notice that Nemo seems to be totally emotionless until this happens. And then he's moved emotionally and he's tearing up. So to me, you get the feeling that he may have been closer to this man,
right,
or this sailor. And then, there's a lot of questions in there that it's like, what's really going on here? I mean, obviously, all of those sailors were philosophically tied to Nemo because they wanted to be there with him. And they very much protected him in what he wanted to do. So
I wonder if he might have felt more emotional context there because he might have felt responsible for them in a way. I think there's a quandary about the if it is some sort of utopia. He is clearly the one in charge, so then everyone else is looking to him for guidance and leadership, and he has a monarchy in a sense on his own ship. The other characters that then Aronnax and Conseil and Ned Land, who just accidentally tumble into his lap, he may have actually found more of a camaraderie and an equality with them because they weren't his underlings, they weren't his servants, they weren't his paid employees, or we don't know why his crew is his crew or what reimbursement they receive for their services in any way. But there seems to just be a different level of relationship there, where his crew is respectful and responsive to him. But these are people who maybe would be an opportunity to actually have a real friendship, because a friend is someone that you don't control, you don't force them to like you, they choose to, and that gives you a connection. So seeing that emotion from him in regards to the loss of that crew member may have been because he knew he was in some way responsible for having brought that person on board and then allowed this person to make that mistake that led to his death. But I just think that creates, it makes him a very lonely character until you see these other, these other protagonists interacting with him.
Yeah. Well, the thing that comes in my mind when they were all on the ship, it's like with Dame Margaret Drabble said, there was no women. I mean, how do you get how many sailors? We don't know how many there were, and there's no women. I mean, that takes a lot of commitment, and obviously it's made very clear in the book, they didn't stop at islands. They didn't go island hopping. They never wanted to go back on land. So I do think there are some concepts in there that Jules Verne is toying with. But I think, we talked about last time about the translation isn't good. Translating from French into English, you miss it. Then here, he wasn't allowed in the academy. Then all of a sudden they go back and study his writings and they realize, oh, he should be in the academy. And it's now affected even modern French thinking, that maybe there's another side of the book that we're not seeing because, well, when it's translated in English, it's translated for little kids, kind of thing. So Deborah, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I think there is, like you say, there is a lot of mystery and interesting concepts to think about, especially with the idea of Nemo and being in charge of all those people and being, like you say, under the water for, I like having his own society. But with it, there's just concepts of like you say, utopia and what is the ideal society but there's always a mystery in the background of something bad's going to happen. Is so often with, even when we talk about dystopian utopian literature, there's like the bad side or the evil side. Everything looks good on the surface, but then underneath there's something not right, and that's happens a lot in some other kinds of literature. So yeah. you kind of wonder if that's the same thing here.
Well, even under the sea, I mean, you can look at it as, I mean, the more I'm talking with all of us, you look at it, okay, well, you remember the whole scene where they're down and they're underneath, they're making their first advance in to go hunting because, Ned is he wants to eat meat. Like, and then, of course, they choose pork, which I don't understand. That doesn't make any health sense today. So they have all that good fish and they want pork, you know. So, but anyway, if you think about it, and, you know, it's like they get down there, and he's like, he doesn't want to be around the world of humans, but they're almost attacked by a tiger shark. And he, but who's the protector? Nemo. Aronnax doesn't see it coming. He gets him, makes him lay down, and the shark goes over top of them. You know, and then there's the spider, the sea spider. So you know, the thing is, I think so many people is, you know, instead of dealing with the problems, they want to escape. And still, even in that oceanic world, there were problems. And then, of course, when they're in Papua New Guinea, all the cannibals want to come and eat them and take them. But the Nautilus has the Nautilus has the solution. You just thunderbolt them, and then they can't come at you, you know, kind of thing. So,
you know, it's an interesting commentary in a way when you look at Aronnax and the fact that he can describe everything. You know, as you see it, you can describe everything. You can categorize it. You can put it into its little niche and everything. But you can't necessarily understand it, because he can describe the world around him, but he can't understand what's really going on. There's this whole thing of mystery that you can perfectly, and like an engineer, you can engineer things, you can be perfect at that, but you still may not understand what's behind it, you know. And so that is an interesting dimension to think about with this book, that there is this sort of tension between understanding and then things are just beyond your understanding because they're mysteries.
Right, right. Well, I think that leads us, I mean, you know, I think everybody knows that, I mean, the JBL is sponsored by the Philadelphia Church of God. I mean, everyone knows that. Here we are, Herbert W. Armstrong College. It is a liberal arts, you know, college, but we're still, it's heavy Bible-oriented. And so if you look at life, I mean, life does have its mysteries, but it really shouldn't be a mystery, because, you know, we believe very definitely that God has revealed the purpose for life, and there's a superior purpose for it. But you know, so many people in this world aren't even willing to investigate. If we tell them what that purpose is, they just can't believe it. And so a lot of writers, I think, like Jules Verne, they see all this mystery and they write about the mystery. And, you know, people are fascinated by the mystery, but they still can't come to the understanding of it. And you know, when we get into our mystery book, I'm going to reveal that next couple of weeks. It's actually a book about mystery, but the mysteries are revealed too. So anyway, it is kind of interesting that way.
Some of what you were saying about that, you know, that categorization. I mean, that's very scientific. Taxonomy, that study of being able to look at what characteristics make something similar and group them together and put, you know, Latin titles on them and put them in their little boxes is very much part of the way that man has explored the world around them and tried to make sense of the world around them. And at the very beginning of the program, you kind of talked about those evolutionary ideas and what maybe Jules Verne actually believed, or what his character believed, or what he had them say. And I read that Jules Verne himself was considered more of, you know, potentially just a deist. He didn't really hold to a specific organized body of religion, but that it did seem as though he had some grander sense of there being, you know, a god or someone that was behind a lot of that. But his character, Aronnax, seems to be a proponent of evolutionary theory. And Charles Darwin obviously had published his work on the Origin of Species before this time, several decades before. Even before Charles Darwin, there was the idea of evolutionary theory, just no one had created a theory about the mechanism of how it happened. So those ideas would have been around long before Darwin even. So with Jules Verne doing such detailed research, you know that he would have researched in depth what a scientist like Aronnax would have believed. And so saying things about the islands, he talks about the new islands, which are only a couple million years old, as opposed to many, many, you know, tens of millions of years old, or talking about life originating in the sea and working its way to land. I do think that's an interesting thing that Jules Verne is doing, because he's telling you what this character believes, and it's very plausible that someone like Aronnax, a highly educated instructor of natural history, would have believed that at that time, or certainly plausible that he would have held that belief. What Jules Verne himself believed, or how that belief, we talked about Nemo maybe being more spiritual. I just think that's an interesting technique that the author uses to present different points of view that may or may not have been the author's own point of view, while still proposing them as very plausible ideas that his characters would have held.
Right. Well, I think that when you bring that up, it kind of makes me realize that I read one review that said that he was probably into evolution. And that just goes to the point where you need to go keep looking, you know, keep digging. And probably had I been more like Jules Verne, I would have gone to 3 or 4 interviews. So let's correct that. I said that in the introduction, and now that Sarah brings that up, so I was wrong. I'll admit it, I was wrong. And it's just because I didn't do enough research. But because the book has that mystery, because like we said in the last program, here Nemo is religious, but it seems like Aronnax is not. I mean, they have this funeral for this sailor that gets killed in an accident, and it's very heavily religious, and it's Nemo that says the prayers, it's Nemo that's conducting it, it's Nemo that's leading it. So there is like it's kind of like it seems non-religious on one side, but then it's very religious on the other. And so I do think Verne is saying more than what, you know, it's more than just 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. There's something else going on in the book that, you know, obviously we can't interview him now, and it'd be a little hard. So it's like with Jane Austen, we can't interview Jane. So, well, guess what? We're running out of time again. And so, you know, taping these programs are not that hard. Well, that sometimes they're hard to get ready for, but looks like we're running out of time. Sorry out there, but I would very much like to hear what you have to say about our Summer of Classics series. Now, next time, I just want to tell you, we're not done with 20,000 Leagues. Next time, we're going to invite our newly formed men's panel in, and we'll finish the discussion of 20,000 Leagues. And then we'll have more about our fall series, which is going to be on utopian and dystopian literature. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter @JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.